CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 114, with Dr. Andrei Dmitriev, overcoming serious life challenges with drive and determination. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. Now, I travel a lot around the world for ophthalmology, and I met an ophthalmologist who I just couldn't believe the life story. Professional athlete, have a heart condition and almost die, become an ophthalmologist, start with nothing, 10 years later, grow your clinic to 50 people, lecture 1,000 times in almost 50 countries. You cannot believe this story. It will teach you the benefit of hard work, determination, and drive and tenacity to be a successful world-class ophthalmologist. Andy, welcome to my podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for the invitation. Great honor. And thanks for the introduction. It's over expectations.
It's amazing. Now, I call you Andy, but please pronounce to us properly your name, because Americans like me may not understand the pronunciation.
So in Polish, it's Andrzej Dmitriev, but it's impossible to pronounce even for Polish people. So for you, I'm Andy, and for majority of my English-speaking friends, it's the same. A long time ago, when I was traveling quite a lot to Asia, they called me Dr. D. So that made even life easier.
Well, that's amazing. Well, we can call you Dr. D, Andy, no problem. Now, Andy, tell us about this incredible life story. I want to know, especially the beginning of your life, you were very involved with athletics, and then you almost died of cardiac issues? Tell me.
Yeah, so, when you're coming from a medical family, it's always an issue because on one side, you know about all the health issues and all the things your grandparents and parents deal with. And on the other hand, it's always like, we call it corridor consultations. So you never actually go to the doctor. You always consult someone who you know, asking like, give me like 10 seconds, I have this issue and that's it. So I was born in a medical family. My grandma was a pediatrician, a great person. She had 3 university degrees, which was very unusual for the lady in like 40s in Poland. My grandpa was ENT, and then my mom was ophthalmologist. So what else can you do in such a family, right?
So yes.
The option is to study medicine. And on the other hand, my father was an engineer. So he was very technical, and I loved math. So my father was very desperate when I decided to consider medicine. But he taught me one very important thing, that actually if your brain is more like math style, then it's much easier for you for the rest of your life. And right. I always think it's like a struggle between two fractions in medicine, between mathematical and physical fraction, and second one is like biology chemistry. And I'm on the math side, so we're like, going right. on... straightforward answers, etc. And sometimes it's quite hard to communicate with that. And that's what I struggled with in the beginning. So when you're coming from a medical family, you have to deal with health issues everywhere. And that, unfortunately, was in my case. And, for someone who's been like professional sports person, and I practiced rowing for majority of my primary school, and then practiced handball during my high school. Suddenly getting very sick after just getting influenza and being sick for like 2 weeks, I ended up with cardiology issues and endocarditis. Spent over 2 months there. What I was told, I almost died. So, I'm very happy and I'm very lucky to be in the place where I am right now.
So you had like a bad luck. You got an endocarditis. You were an inpatient for 2 months and you almost died.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then 1 month on vancomycin. It's never easy.
Because your whole family was in the medical field, from your grandparents to your mother to your siblings, they said, he's fine, don't worry.
Actually, it was my mom who brought me to the hospital at that time, and I was very lucky to have my mom at that time. She passed away 2 years ago, unfortunately, but she was an amazing person, a very hardworking woman, and she struggled all her life. But she actually brought me from home to the hospital, and she said, you know, you're really sick, you need to go over to the hospital, and that probably saved my life.
Right. Sometimes, as ophthalmologists, sometimes we forget that we also must be, you know, physicians first. Sometimes we get so caught up in, the fine details. Like, we are all, every ophthalmologist, especially if you do cataract and refractive surgery, you are a mathematician. I mean, everything is math.
So you know, it's like we keep forgetting about ourselves, our own health, and that's probably one of the best lessons I have. So, first of all, if you're a physician, you need to remember about your own health.
You're right.
If you're not healthy, you cannot help other people. So that's like a condition to work and to fully function.
Yes, we have a saying here for the U.S., which is, doctor, heal yourself. Heal thyself first.
Yeah. That's very true, and coming from ancient times. So, you know, we should just remember about it during our daily life. When you do like your 20 or 30 eyes during the day, and you're so happy that you completed your surgical day. But at the end of the day, think whether you can make it to the next week.
Right. That's why so important to do bench press, weightlifting. As you know, cataract coach, I love weightlifting.
Yep. So quality of life first.
Right. So how did you decide to do ophthalmology? Because of your brother and your mom, the influence? How did you choose ophthalmology?
So many people say, and I thought that my mom influenced my decision, but generally, I think it was, my personal idea to become an eye doctor. And actually, we never worked together with my mom. And she was a typical Polish post-communist ophthalmologist. So she had to prescribe glasses and display contact lenses, as we didn't have optometrists at that time. And, you know, our ophthalmologist needed to be like both optometrists and eye doctors at the same time. So there was a funny story in 1989 because, it was still the time under communism, and it was so hard to get reasonable equipment. So my mom had a colleague in Vienna, and she was actually exchanging her equipment. And I called my mom saying, you know, I have a very nice Zeiss slit lamp, which is like 35 or 40 years old, but it's still very useful. The only problem is that if it's shipped to Poland, then you pay like two or three times the value of customs and taxes and everything, which doesn't make sense. So they decided to disassemble the whole slit lamp. And they sent like the whole slit lamp in a big box, like all the single screws, all the single pieces, like without any manual, no instruction, nothing. And I was 12 years old, and we got this huge box. And I was sitting with that for like 3 months, and I finally assembled the lamp, and it's still working until now.
Wow. So when you were 12 years old, you basically got all the parts, like down to individual screws, and you had to assemble a slit lamp at the age of 12. So when I was playing with Legos, you were assembling a slit lamp.
I left Legos at that time. You know, my mom had to get some money at that time, and we had so-called international fairs in Poland. So foreign companies were allowed to come for like international fairs, and my mom worked with Denmark. Wow. And she worked next to the Lego pavilion. So each year I was able to select like a big box of Lego, which was very unusual in communist times. So I loved it, you know, and slit lamp was a little bit like, you know, connecting bricks, more or less the same.
Well, I know, but if you ask me today, and I'm a little bit past the age of 50, I could not assemble a slit lamp from scratch today. I couldn't do it.
You know, people still know me, so whenever something doesn't work and they need it, you know, working right now, sometimes they call me at the hospital saying, you know, Andy, please, we know you can do it. So even if I'm like co-owning the clinic and all the professional issues have been so different right now, sometimes, you know, you love helping people. So
that's fantastic. Now, you always were ahead of the bell curve. You were always like first there. Like for FACO, you were one of the very first residents in Poland to complete a FACO surgery. Tell me about that. That's a very different time.
That was because, you know, I was actually in my second year of residency. And that time, like none of the residents was able to learn FACO during residency. So if you were a son of a professor, that was a different case. But I wasn't. So, you know, my idea was simple. So first I went to one of the very nice German surgical congresses. That was in 2004. And the main reason was that for Eastern European doctors, it was for free and the wet labs were for free. So I took advantage of that. So I went to this wet lab. I was sitting with like 60 plus German ophthalmologists and we were like saying, hello, where are you from? So I said, I'm from Poland. He was like, so where are you based? Why did you come here? Because there are no wet labs in Poland. He like left me with a microscope and said, you know, just take your time. I'm just gonna take another wet lab and use it. And I actually had the same experience when I joined the ESCRS wet lab for the first time, and my first AAO in Chicago in 2005. Amazing wet lab with Dr. Lisa Arbisser from she's a former president of the AAO.
And, we know Lisa Arbisser very well. We've had her on the podcast here on Cataract Coach. She's amazing.
I know. I saw that. So you know, when she realized that I'm like a person from Poland, like there were only Americans in the room, and I was the only person from abroad. She approached me. She gave me all her videos and everything. She supported me for the whole 2 hours. Amazing person. So that's the lesson of the lifetime. So that's why, you know, When I completed my residency in 2009, I started teaching other people because I thought that's the best thing I can do to transfer my knowledge to help others do the same. So I'm still teaching FACO.
I love it. That's so important. And the secret that sometimes people don't realize is that by teaching, I become a better surgeon.
Yep, exactly. So you know, last year I went to Mexico with a group of American surgeons for a cataract mission, and we were like three doctors in charge and three residents with us. So we were just responsible for supervising them at the same time, you know, just helping people. And we had like 95% of brunescent, black, and white cataracts.
Right.
So it's a different world, and there was just an amazing lesson how really help people in need. So on three tables, we did like 85 cases during 2 days.
Wow.
And I think I don't really remember happier myself than at that time. And sometimes you just need to find yourself in a strange environment, like somewhere in Mexico, and realize that's how the life is. That's like why life is what life is all about.
Right. I think we are so lucky as ophthalmologists, especially if we do cataract surgery or anterior segment surgery, that we have a skill that we can go to almost any country on this entire planet and offer so much good and so much help to so many people. Right. You can literally make the blind people see. It's amazing. It's truly a miracle of life. And we have this skill in our hands that we can use to improve the lives of so many. It's amazing.
So, you know, I have a trick. Like when I have a patient with like very, very advanced cataract, like, you know, HM or LP. So what I do in the beginning when I cover the second eye and I ask them whether they can see anything in the beginning of surgery. So when I ended up and I take the microscope light to the sides and then I ask them to look towards my face and they're like, Doc, I can see you. And it's like the joy of a lifetime. It's
right.
Nothing better, which you can experience in ophthalmology.
Right. If you are a young ophthalmologist and you've got reasonable, pretty good cataract skills, you should definitely do one of these charity trips to some part of the world. Because not only will it help so many people, you will become a better surgeon because you have the most difficult, brunescent, dense cataracts. And you have oftentimes very rudimentary or old-fashioned equipment. And it will really test your skills as a surgeon. And you will become a better surgeon. And it not only incredibly improves your dexterity and your skill set, it feeds your soul. You feel like such a good person. You just, it's life-changing.
It does. Today, it's like, you know, I still remember, like, on Wednesday, I was operating my patients, you know, capsule laser capsulotomies, advanced lenses. I'm using 75% of EDOF and multifocals. And you do that with all those clear lens extractions. And then 3 days later, you end up with, 40-year-old microscopes and 25-year-old phacos.
Right.
And you still need to get through it, right? And there's no laser.
Yeah, I remember doing a trip once to Tonga in the middle of the South Pacific where there's no ophthalmologist for the entire country. Maybe there's one. And we go there to do the surgeries, and I had brought all these IOLs, and I brought some cartridges, but I didn't have the injector. So I had to make my own plunger to use with the cartridge in order to get the lenses delivered inside the eyes. So it makes you really think on your feet.
Yeah, so you need to become creative, otherwise it doesn't work.
Right. No, for sure. Those are really amazing. Now, on these trips, though, I think it's important for a surgeon to know you must be not only an excellent phaco surgeon, you must know how to do MSICS, a small incisional manual extraction. You have to.
Exactly. So you need to know all the conversions, and sometimes you need to get back to intracap. And you have subluxated lenses and all the potential issues which can come out, which were present 20 or 30 years ago. So we don't experience that right now in our country so much. We only have maybe like a 2% rate of premature cataracts, maybe even less. Right. So it's still like something very unusual to see that. But then you realize that these people who get operated only in one eye have this lifetime opportunity to see, and if there is any significant complication, then you think about what's going to happen next, right? So first of all, you need to supervise your trainees, but at the same time think about the person, the life which they're going to get through.
For sure. Now, you said that in your clinic now, 70% of patients are getting a multifocal, trifocal, or extended up the focus lens. That seems like a lot.
It is. And so the construction of the clinic is that 100% of patients are paying out of the pocket. So our public healthcare in Poland is very similar to NHS in UK. So there's no co-payments, there are no options. So if you want to get a reasonable lens, you need to pay for the full procedure, right?
Mm.
So our construction right now is that we completely stopped using monofocals. And that was a year and a half ago. So instead of monofocals, we're implanting enhanced monofocals or monofocal plus lenses.
Okay.
And
okay.
That's more like a standard package, which is about 20-25% of patients. And for the rest, it's EDOF, spiral, and multifocal. And sometimes it's combinations of these three. Sometimes it's using the same type of lens in both eyes. But I'm very happy to use basically everything what is registered in within European markets.
Now, you look like you're around my age, maybe about age 50 or so, or close to it, right?
47.
Okay, you're getting there. You're a few years behind me. Now, if you're a 50-year-old plano presbyope, which IOL are you getting?
I'm very happy not to be a presbyope, so I'm still
Well, that's for now. Like, you know, that's
20
for 47.
Centimeters.
No, no, my friend, I hate to be the bearer of bad news.
I know it's for now. I'm experiencing a small myopic shift in my dominant eye for some unknown reason. Hopefully not a cataract. But you'll probably ask me, like, which lens or which technology.
And you just teach me something. Well, you're 47 today. You're 47 today. But okay, fast forward 6 years. Now you're 53. Now what do you want to do?
So first of all, I'm a very tall person. It seems that I'm a perfect candidate to get EDOFs in both eyes with, let's say, 0.5 monovision. But on the other hand, I'm very used to reading from very very small distances. So what I'm using more and more frequently recently is EDOF lens in the dominant eye mm-hmm. and multifocal in the non-dominant. Or since the introduction of spiral technology by Rainer, I started mixing it up with EDOFs as well. So sometimes we're using combination of EDOF in the dominant and spiral in the non-dominant, or two spiral lenses as well. So we still don't know whether there is one technology which could be optimal for majority of our patients. And we still play with so many lenses. And at the moment, I'm planting probably like 12 different technologies and lenses. So it's really hard to tell you no company X or Y. But right. I think in my case, just because I'm so tall, EDOF with multifocal, or EDOF with spiral, or two EDOFs with 0.5 diopter monovision would be an option.
I think that EDOF with 0.5 monovision is great. I had a patient in my own clinic very recently who was very tall. For Americans, he was 6'5" tall. For everywhere else in the world, that's 2 meters. So he's 200 centimeters tall guy, about like you. And the amazing part is, I set it up the focus lens in one eye, first eye, hit emmetropia plano. Pretty good range, about 1.5 diopters worth. But as you know, 1.5 diopters is going to be a little far out. That's going to be like 67 centimeters. So the other eye, the non-dominant eye, aimed for minus 0.5, was so happy because now the near point with that eye is about 50 centimeters. And with a tall person who's 200 centimeters tall, 50 centimeters is just about perfect. So that patient was absolutely happy.
Yeah. Seems like a scenario for me as I'm 6'6", so very similar.
Right, very similar. So you're also 200 centimeters.
So at least I know where to go, you know? I just need to note down your Beverly Hills clinic address just for future reference.
come anytime. Now, the tougher part is, now, what would you do for someone like me? Early to mid-50s, minus 2 sphere. I'm definitely presbyopic. And minus 2 sphere, just for reference, even my glasses, I only wear minus 175 because I don't like it too sharp. What do you do for me? I'm stuck.
I hate these patients. I really hate these patients, to be honest, you know?
Yeah, everyone hates me. I get it.
As a lens-based surgeon, I just hate myopes with something between like minus 1.5 and minus 3. So, you know, my clinic is very balanced between laser refractive surgery and lens-based surgery.
Right.
So I'm very happy that my brother, there is a 7-year difference between us. He's much younger, but he's a great laser vision correction surgeon. And, you know, we're still not performing refractive lens exchange till the age of 55 in myopes.
Right.
We know there is a significantly higher risk of retinal detachment in those eyes. So in case of hyperopes, we still do it starting at the age of 40. In case of myopes, we just push laser and ICLs till the age of 55, sometimes even longer. And for many of my patients, this is what we do. Either laser visual correction, or if a patient says, you know, I'm just afraid about dry eye. I'm so cautious about having reversible procedure. I want to save my virgin eyes for future calculation of the lens, which is more precise right. when you do the ICL. Many patients want it just because it's reversible and leaves your cornea untouched.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, let me ask you, how did you grow your clinic? You started off alone 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And now there are 50 people there.
This is just amazing. You know, I had one empty room. There was 1 month before I started. Okay. And there was no one else. And there was no equipment, no one else. So, you know, I started calling people like my nurses from other clinics. And, you know, I took over so many people from the place which I left, which was a big network, ophthalmology network, like a big clinic with 20 years of history, you know, lots of patients. But, you know, I called them saying, you know, I want to build something new. And maybe if you're going to join me, we're going to be friends for a lifetime and working together. Right. And believe it or not, but still, these people still work with me. So we started from the scratch, from nothing. After 4 months, I bought excimer laser. Then, you know, we were just slightly afraid of over-investing a little bit, but we moved forward. And there was a very, very nice moment, a great time when that was probably like 3 or 4 years ago. I got a phone call from a boss of one of the IOL companies in Poland, inviting me to Warsaw to visit his office. And I was like, so what's the reason? You'll see. So I visited his office and he was like, you know, you just became our biggest partner in the advanced technology IOLs.
Wow.
And I was just sitting there, you know, and I was, wow. So we're building something from the scratch. And you have so many nice clinics, so many professors, so many people doing great work and having a brand for years. And we started building from nothing. And suddenly someone tells you, you know, you're the biggest. So obviously it doesn't mean you're biggest for a lifetime. And it doesn't mean quality mm-hmm. follows being the biggest one. Because we are still focusing on the patient, focusing on quality, focusing on predictability of refraction, all the small things. And we're still trying to do that.
I guess next thing you know, every year you just keep growing and growing and growing. And
next locations is the next step.
So what are the big challenges? We have a lot of young ophthalmologists, usually in their 30s and 40s, who listen to Cataract Coach. How do you grow the practice? What are the big challenges? Okay, you started off single ophthalmologist, just seeing a few patients. How do you get more and more people in the door to come into your clinic?
There are a couple of ways to achieve success. First of all, it's reasonable to start with a bigger company or bigger clinic because first you need to learn the corporate communication. And it's so hard to build it by yourself. Right. So that's one of the things I was able to learn at the first private clinic I worked for. So, you know, reading emails, reading procedures and seeing how it works, maybe seeing what they do wrong and maybe what should be corrected. At the same time, I was trying to be very active in medical congresses, lecturing quite a lot, doing quite a lot of courses to build a referring network. And at some point, I just took the risk. I thought that maybe if people know me, if patients know me and I'm brave enough to do that, to invest my money, maybe it's going to be successful. And actually, it's always a risk. So you never know whether you succeed or not. But it's really worth it, believe me.
What's the hardest or what's the most difficult part in practice? To me, I always tell young doctors, the hardest part is getting a patient to walk into your clinic doors.
Yeah.
How do you do it?
So marketing is absolutely the most important issue which you need to solve. But I would call it medical marketing first. So first, convince your colleagues that you're doing a good job, that your medical quality is high, and this is how you're getting referrals. So we started from very small conferences for 10, 20, 30 eye doctors, optometrists, telling them, you know, we're going to be your partners. So if you have a patient who's going to need a premium lens, bring the patient to us, and we're going to send the patient back. So we're not going to keep this patient. We're going to work together, because we're willing to grow your business in the same way as I'm willing to grow mine, right? So that was the first step. Obviously, you need to consider all the options which are available right now. You need to invest in Google. You need to invest in social media. Would I say that it's necessary to start a clinic? I wouldn't say that. I think you need to build your online presence, but it's not like the only condition which you need to go through. And I know so many doctors who spend like majority of their time recording videos and trying to build their online presence, but they're actually forgetting about building referral network. And it has the same level of importance. So talk to your colleagues, have lots of personal connections, and build it one by one, patient by patient, bringing the patient back, sending the patient back to the doctor who recommended you, and say thank you when it's a Christmas time, send a bottle of wine to your colleagues saying, you know, I appreciate it so much that you helped me, you know, operating these two or three patients. I think this is how it works. So it's very personal.
Yeah, in the USA, we have a challenge. Like, I can certainly tell you about the Los Angeles market. Now, I promise, if you have a patient who wants a beautiful cataract surgery, you have seen hundreds of videos of me operating. If that patient comes in Los Angeles to me, I promise they'll get the highest level of care that is possible. But the problem is, the referring optometrists in Los Angeles, the vast majority, far more than 90% of them, only refer to the ophthalmologists who pay them the most in co-management or referral fees. And I don't pay anything because I don't think it's ethical to pay these co-management fees. So then I don't know, in Los Angeles, how do I take your advice and put it to work? Because in Los Angeles, if I go to an optometrist and say, listen, I'd love to help you with these patients, I promise you, I have incredible skill here. I have 1,000 YouTube videos. You can watch me operate unedited. I promise I'm giving the top level care, better than who you're referring to now. But then they'll say, but the other doctor pays me X amount of money. You pay me nothing.
That's absolutely true. So it's really a big problem, especially when it comes to the networks, the big organisms of you know, where equity funds invest, and they have specific ways of building these networks of referrals with optometrists and actually paying for that. So what I try to do is convincing these people that actually it's not just a corporation which is very commercial, but at the same time, you know, at some point they need some support in case of their families, their parents, they need, you know, reasonable cataract surgery. And this is what I tell them, look, just call me then. If your mom or your dad has a problem, I'll be very happy to personally take care of that. If your dad or mom needs cataract surgery, I'm going to invite you to sit there with me to observe the cataract surgery. And this is what they do. I do the same with IMDs. They come to my OR, they sit there and watch the surgery, right? So they really appreciate it. We give them the best lenses possible. We tell them, you know, we're going to decrease the price as much as possible because you're our partners, right? You're like our family.
Yeah.
And I think this is how you build it step by step. Obviously, you won't convince anyone, but if someone's just willing to get the money from that, then if you pay the money, there is always someone who pays a little bit more.
Right. And,
are you really willing to build your network based on such people? I'm not convinced.
Well, you, Andy, are a better man than me. Because in the example... No, for sure. Because in the example you gave, recently I had an optometrist ask me to do surgery on a family member for them. But I know this optometrist for 15 years. And for the last 15 years, this optometrist only sends surgery patients to some other ophthalmologist, because that ophthalmologist pays the most money. But to be frank, that ophthalmologist is not a world-class surgeon. And now for their family, you want me to do the surgery? So I said, no. I said, you should I said, you're used to working with another surgeon.
Yep.
Send your family member to that surgeon. I'm out. So I'm probably too emotional, too stupid, and a bad businessman, and not as smart as you.
You know, I would say I'm too soft in situations like that. And in many cases, I say, you know, I just do a favor and do the same for your members of family, because it's ethical, I think. And if I think I can offer them something reasonable, obviously financial part is another story. But first of all, you want to help people, and maybe I need to learn something from you.
No, I think, to be honest, I think you're smarter than I am. But I mean, if you want to question ethics, the ethics is the doctor, optometrist, who knowingly sends patients to a surgeon they wouldn't want their own family member to go to in order to get the most revenue, the most money sent back to them. Ah, come on. So honestly, in a different life, I would rather be smart like you.
So let's just hope at some point these practices would just stay away from medical world, because you know, when you mix it so much, when you try to involve so much money in relationships between medical stuff, it doesn't help. It doesn't help at all.
Right.
It doesn't increase quality.
Now let me change gears here before I get into trouble talking too much about this. Now, I was also very impressed. You're a great lecturer. When you're on the podium, you talk about IOL technologies or phaco, or actually the newest is YAG vitreolysis. You're a very good speaker, very engaging. Now, how did you go from a private practice surgeon to giving almost 1,000 lectures in 45 countries? How do you grow that?
Actually, I started being a university teacher over 20 years ago, and that was my background. So, you know, I worked with students during the whole university time. So when I became a student union president during my university, I had to speak and you know, stand in front of hundreds and thousands of people quite on a frequent basis. And at some point, you just realize you're just not getting afraid of so many people in front of you.
Right.
That's one thing. Second is, I think you need to listen to yourself. So try recording your voice and listen to what you said, whether it's clear and easy to understand. Because if it's not, then first you won't understand yourself. And it's the same in the position of other people. So I started lecturing in 2003 when I joined the university as a teacher. I criticized the university being a student union president, and I tried to reform the education there.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when I found myself on the other side, there were many people within student union who worked with me saying, you know, now we're going to see how it works for you, whether you can be on the other side, and whether you can be a good teacher. So I'm very happy that, you know, our English-speaking students, we have almost 1,000 English-speaking students at our university, mainly Americans, Canadians, Scandinavians, and Taiwanese. And they always select, every single year, they select three teachers out of more than 2,000. And these teachers are given the awards for best teachers each year. And I got this award 5 times.
Oh, wow.
So,
I love it.
You know, you can get lots of awards, but there's nothing better than your own students giving you the award at the end of the university, because it's from their heart.
Absolutely.
And, there's nothing better than teaching students, I think.
Oh, well, you are a man after my own heart. In fact, right above me here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 awards for best professor in UCLA ophthalmology, and no other professor has even gotten 2, and I got 5 sitting right there above my head. So no, we're the same. We're both 5-time award winning.
But yeah, exactly.
But you're no question, you're a great speaker. You're fantastic as a teacher.
Thank you.
But how did you start from getting invited to one international meeting to another? How does that grow?
It's even harder when you're from Poland because it all started for me, you know, back in like 2007 or 8. So you know, I was a resident at that time and I actually started doing FACO at the clinic. And okay. At some point during my residency, I was stopped for 2 years.
Why?
Politics.
You never okay. know. Okay. You never know.
So for 2 years, I had nothing in common with ophthalmic surgery. So I was very frustrated. I was sent to ultrasound room for almost 2 years. So I was thinking like, you know, if I'm there, so how about if I start doing something with the knowledge which I get there? So after 6 months, I developed first Polish video ultrasound course in ophthalmology, which was completely awesome. Built on videos. That was awesome. Back in like 2007, I guess. So back in 2008, I think, I delivered this course in English during a meeting which was organized by a Polish distributor. And there were people from Alex. I think you remember Alex Ultrasounds company.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so they were acquired then by Quantel. But at that time, it was like the most prestigious company in ultrasound. So they saw me during a lecture. They approached me after the lecture and said, you know, would you be interested in delivering ultrasound lectures in English? And I was like, how about that? So at that time, I started my international speaking career. And that had lots of very funny moments. Probably one of the best ones was when I was speaking in Asia. I was in Asia probably like 150 times altogether.
Wow.
So really a lot. At some point, we were teaching young laser vitrealizers with Paul Singh. You know Paul Singh probably, right?
Yeah. From Wisconsin. Paul Singh from Wisconsin, USA.
Yes, Paul Singh. Exactly.
We had him on the podcast yes. also talking about the same topic.
That's it. So we were speaking with Paul and teaching like hands-on young laser vitrealizers in Japan for 1 week. So he went south of Tokyo, I went north of Tokyo. And after 1 week, we had a meeting, we had the dinner together in Tokyo and... you know, people from there asked us, like, so what would you like to do for the rest of the evening? And we're a little bit confused, you know, how many drinks can you have? And I was like, how about if we go to Japanese karaoke? That was a brilliant idea, wasn't it?
Paul, he's a professional
Paul
musician.
Paul can sing.
He's professional.
He is. So I still have those videos. And I was singing Bob Dylan and UB40 at that time. We're singing together a Japanese karaoke with our dear friends from Australia. So can you imagine American, Polish, and Australian singing in Japanese karaoke in Tokyo?
I love it.
You know, over expectations.
Amazing.
So I just love Paul. He's an unbelievable person, great surgeon, great teacher. So I learned a lot from him.
Yeah, that's the beauty in ophthalmology really is the friends you can make, the colleagues you can make.
Yep.
That is like when I met you, I was like, wow, this guy is amazing. I have to have him on my podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, really. It's an honor. But, you know, it's just sometimes that you're very lucky because how else can you call it? You know, there are so many situations in your life and sometimes it's like coincidence of different things. And then you realize you won like a lottery. So,
right. I think if you give out good energy, yeah. you kind of get back good energy.
It gets back.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it is. And then I also realized in ophthalmology, first, every ophthalmologist I've ever met is incredibly smart. And if you put me against your average ophthalmologist, I'm actually on the bottom end of the bell curve. I'm among all ophthalmologists, I promise you, I'm among the stupidest. But I just have like a really hard work ethic. So I work really hard. And it's just like, it's fun to connect with others because I already know you're good at math. already know you're super smart. I already know you're like meticulous, you're perfectionist, attention to detail. So I get your personality because it's like me looking in the mirror.
Yeah. I had this impression when we met for the first time. And sometimes it's a little bit like looking into the mirror saying, come on, it cannot be true. It's like, it's such a similar type, you know, and it's really a great experience.
Yeah, I said all ophthalmologists are about the same. Believe me, we're all cut from the same cloth. That's why we're not the one. If you look at like medical school graduates, people in medical school, what is it, like 1% choose ophthalmology or something like this? Something tiny?
Yeah. And so you really need to be like, you know, top 2% or top 1% to get there. And it's not easy. And that's something I was telling to my brother, you know, first of all, you need to believe it's the thing you want to experience for the rest of your professional life. But second, you just need to be good enough to do that, right?
Right. No, for sure. Absolutely. Ophthalmologist, it's a tough field. I mean, there's so much to learn. The amazing part is, I just think back, if I was going to do ophthalmology residency again today, there's so much more material to learn.
There is.
Oh my gosh, there's so much. In the same few years, in the US it's 4 years. In the same 4 years, I'd have to learn twice as much material. It's crazy.
But don't you think that when you're lecturing, it's so much easier to understand and remember things? And that's why, you know, when we bought, I still remember the moment when we bought the first OCT to our clinic in like 2004, you know, the old Zeiss Stratus. And like no one had OCTs at that time. And I collected like a bunch of images and cases. And I thought, how about if I just collect it in the lecture and deliver it to people to help them understand how it works, right? Then it was the same with ultrasound, same with IOL technologies, IOL calculations. I started teaching IOL calculations back in like 2006 when like no one in this part of Europe was speaking about right. IOL calculations. But then you understand how it works and you see what changes in the process, what can be done, what's not perfect. And then it's easier to work.
That is true. I mean, I remember getting our first OCT machine and looking at scans of the macula, which were these old first generation machines were very low definition.
Yeah.
But what blew me away was when I was a resident, and I'm a few years older than you, I finished residency in 2000. When I was a resident, I had this atlas from a retina specialist called Don Gass, the father of the macula, the Don Gass atlas. Professor Gass would look with a 78 diopter lens at the macula, and he would draw a picture which was identical to the OCT machine. The man could see at the level of an OCT with his own eyes, which always made me feel like a fool because I could never see this stuff until I got the OCT machine.
Yeah.
So it just shows you.
But you know, I'm still teaching, like, I don't do diagnostic courses anymore, but I'm still teaching students about gas classification and how it was actually possible to diagnose, like, macular holes without having OCTs.
Just
by using your eyes, slit lamp, and the beam of light, just by narrowing it and all that stuff. So there are not so many people who still remember that.
I know, but that makes me feel like, among ophthalmologists, I'm kind of one of the dumb ones because, like, I could never see that until I got the OCT machine. And, like, finally with the OCT machine, oh, now I understand what Professor Gass is talking about. Okay, now I get it. Amazing.
Did you have to draw the iPhones with pencils?
And, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Who remembers about it? And we did it for like so many years, and every single patient needed to get one. And sometimes you needed to correct it like three or four times. So you needed to have like 20 drawings to finally have the ideal one, right?
I mean, it was so crazy. The lucky thing for me is I'm a big guy like you. I have a 71 millimeter pupillary distance, and I can see 2 arc seconds of stereo. So I got incredible depth perception. But even then, I didn't have the brains to be able to see the macula like Don Gass did. So thank goodness we have an OCT machine. So now I can finally understand it.
We're really lucky. You know, there's so much technology in our lives. And the only thing you need is just to understand how it works. And sometimes this is what people need. So we need to teach them how to use specific technologies.
Right. No, for sure. For sure. So now tell me one last thing here. Now, you also have two boys who are in ophthalmology or going to be in ophthalmology, hopefully.
We'll see. We'll see. So my older son started medicine last October. And I'm just not trying to warm it up. And we have like easy conversation. And I'm telling him, you know, you need to get through couple of years of clinics, see how surgeries, how internal medicine and other stuff. And then you decide. Because it needs to be his decision, right?
Yes, for sure. 100%. For sure.
My youngest son is only 12. So, you know, he has only soccer in his head and YouTube video shorts. That's probably the most important part.
Listen, he'll have a... If he can be like Lionel Messi, he'll be fine.
We'll see.
Well, I think like you do. Both of my kids are in their early 20s. They're both in medical school here in the USA. And my job is to just shut up and I don't say anything. I say, do what makes you happy and let me stay out of your way.
Yeah.
And if you decide it's for you, then great.
It's so hard to do that. Yeah. It's so hard to, you know, to just to observe and say nothing. It's, oh, I'm just sweating, you know, I almost cannot make it.
Well, you know, like, the reason why my kids do well is because they don't listen to me. I taught them when they were very young. I said, listen, don't ever listen to me. Don't listen to anyone else. Use your own brains. Listen to yourself.
They need to collect their experiences. And we did the same. So without that, we wouldn't be skilled enough to do whatever we do on a daily basis.
Plus, I think, like you've seen in your life, in my life, in anyone's life, you need to go through periods where it's a little bit tough. It's a little bit unfair. You struggle a little bit because that builds the grit and that drive and that determination so you get better. If life is too easy, you won't do as well.
Exactly. And probably there's not a better place than US to experience that. And if you see what happens to people leaving the countries for many reasons, economic, political, and other ones, and finding U.S. as their mecca, as the place to build their lives and careers. And you see the second generations, which are getting like wonderful scientists, physicians, professors. Then you know that sometimes the life needs to be a little bit harder to push you a little bit and reach your borders. And then you're really getting a good person.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the older I get in life, the more I realize it's a zero-sum game. You need to have negatives to balance out the pluses because at the end of your life, it's all about a zero sum.
That's it.
Right. And it's also why I know if I'm in the negative right now, if I'm having a bad time and I've got a lot of challenges or problems right now, I just know, have faith, hold on. The good times are coming just around the corner. And then similarly, if life is great right now, let me enjoy every moment. Because in the future, there are going to be some challenges and some problems.
But you need to be brave enough to get to the corner and see what's there. Because if you just stand there still and you don't move, there's no progress.
That is true. You have to go after life and get it. Don't let life wash over you like water. Like, no, you have to go get it.
That's it. So that's my big honor. And, you know, I started attending American Academy of Ophthalmology in 2005. Never single year since then I'm visiting it. Just because I think there's not a better place than US to observe how many things can be done just with the skills and brains. And just to observe all those fantastic people and great minds and learn from them.
I think you're right. Listen, my parents were immigrants to the USA in 1967. And my parents, they're both passed away, but they were both the biggest, biggest patriots of the USA because this was an amazing place. It gave incredible opportunities. And so I'm a huge American patriot now. I'm so proud to be an American. And it's just like the opportunities given here for my parents and for me and for my kids. I don't know if it would have been the same anywhere else on the planet.
That's true. But for the same reason, I left Poland, you know, my parents were mixed from, I had my mother's family with a little bit of German roots. I had my father's family with Russian, Lithuanian, and Belarusian roots. So, you know, that's the combination of this part of Europe which we have, because the borders have been changing over time.
Right, right.
We had two world wars, and still the war is going on in Ukraine, and there is such a bad situation. But that was life, and they needed to leave their homes to move to a new place. And there was a struggle. My father was only like 5 or 6 years old when he moved from near Vilnius to Poland, and they had to start from scratch.
Yeah, well, what a similar story. I mean, the same thing for my parents. When my dad was 5 years old, India got split from the British leaving, and my dad like, that's it, you have to move. Get lost, get moving. So, well, but it just shows you that the more I travel, the more I realize people around the world are basically the same.
Yeah.
Hardworking, value family, value success that you achieve on your own, and they're resilient.
But if you just believe in yourself and believe in people you're working with, I think it's getting much easier. And then you can use your skills and brains much better.
Oh, I totally agree. Now, I want to encourage our listeners and viewers. If you see Andy at one of these international meetings, you'll recognize him in a minute because he's the tallest ophthalmologist you'll see. He's going to be 200 centimeters tall, 2 meters tall, or for Americans, about 6 foot six. When you see him, just stop him and say hello. I am so glad we got to spend time together internationally in Europe. And again, I want to thank you so much for this podcast. It was a tremendous amount of fun for me to chat with you. And can you believe it's already been an hour?
Uday, thank you so much for the invitation. I always dreamt of, talking to you in person. But being here is just over my expectations. Great honor, and thank you again.
Oh, my pleasure. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we have a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we now have the Retina Rounds podcast every Sunday as well. A retina doctor going into a lot of more detail in the podcast. And of course, every single day, there's a new Cataract Coach video. We're almost at 2,600 videos and a new one every day. And a new Retina Rounds video every day. So check it out. And until next time, I'll catch you later.